my acquaintance with the company was from two sources. First, when I was in Rice, at the beginning of my senior year, Mr. McCann, whom, as you know, lived on the corner from us on Milford, called me in one day and told me that he had had a call from a family that lived in Rosmoyne, which was just south of Turn Edition, where we live, who needed someone to coach their blind son. And of course, in those years, in that year, fall of 1929, I needed money desperately and was glad to undertake this job. And in addition, I was grading papers for the English department at Rice. And was also, this was the year in which I was having all my trouble with my eyes. So I had a considerable burden on my hand, but I did go over once a week, all that fall and spring, and undertook to coach Chris Towns, who was the blind son of Edgar and Mrs. Towns. This was a particularly hard job because he didn't have any particular background in anything. He hadn't been to school very much, but he was interested in the Bible. He knew the Bible thoroughly and familiarly. He was interested in a philosophic background to back up his Bible studies. So what I did was to try to dictate to him, which he took down in Braille, a kind of a short course in the history of philosophy, which I'd gotten out of the course from Dr. Sano the year before. And Chris and I became quite good friends. But unfortunately, I didn't follow him. I couldn't follow him after I went on to law school and thereafter. He died some years ago, maybe 10 years ago. He did marry. I don't believe he had any children. And I don't think he was able to do anything with his life, considering his handicap. My other entry into the Humble Company was through my mother's friendship with Thelma Baker, wife of Heinz Baker. They were members together of the current literature club of Houston. And Mrs. Baker knew that Nanny was a widow and that she had a son, and that she knew in general who I was, and undoubtedly mentioned my name to Hines, and in turn probably got mentioned to Mr. Towns. And then too, when after I got out of law school in 1933, which was 3 years after this coaching adventure, I went by to see Mr. Towns, and in addition to calling on other people at that time, and applied for a job. And of course, he told me, as everybody was telling all applicants for law jobs in those days, that there simply weren't any law jobs available, and it didn't look like there would ever be any. So I went on to Galveston to work for a year and a half or so with Bradley Harris, who was an admiralty lawyer there and who had a fair amount of business. And that was a fair beginning interlude. There was really nothing else to do, so it was not a bad interlude at all. And we had a reasonably good time there because Mother had a cousin there, Francis Lockhart, who belonged to one of the old Galveston families, and we got invited to a lot of nice places. And we went to the gambling den out on the pier at numerous parties, and I was able to play golf at the municipal golf course, which was then a very nice course. And so we had a pretty fair time in Galveston. In those days, we liked to go swimming every evening, which was amazing to me at this time, but at age 23 or 24, that was what we liked to do, and we did that every day before supper. And somehow or other, the seawater seemed clear and beautiful in those days, and the sand seemed clean, and there weren't too many people about, and of course, and then we were young, and it was very, very nice. I'd completely forgotten about the fact that I'd mentioned to Mr. Towns that if anything ever came up, I'd appreciate a call from him. But one day in about April or May of 1934, I did get a call from him while I was in Galveston. He asked me whether I would like to have a job. And that was simply unheard of in the year 1934, of anybody offering any lawyer a job. There were all sorts of jokes running around about how lawyers had to act as circus clowns in circuses, and they're doing all sorts of strange things in order to make a living. So I went up to Houston and interviewed the Mr. Towns, and he did offer me a job, and of course I took it. I had maybe a few misgivings at that time, because I sensed at the beginning at the Humble Company would be not as interesting or as thrilling as working in a small office where in a variety of cases would come in and you'd have a variety of things to do. I sensed that the work they would give me at the beginning would be more or less routine and dull, paperwork, and I wouldn't have too much contact with the people on the outside. And that indeed proved to be correct. But at any rate, as of June 1, 1934, we moved up to Houston, and I started in work with the Humble Company. At that time, the three of us, mother and I and Nanny, moved back to the Milford House, which was in a dismal state of repair, but we lived there anyhow. And I went to work every day at the Humble Company on the bus, which came down Montrose Boulevard. And we lived in Milford from 1934 till 1936, until we completed the Coleridge Street house, at which time we moved there, and at the same time Nanny had built and occupied a house behind the Coleridge Street house, her house on Marlow. And so we remained in West University Place for 9 years, and Nanny stayed longer, of course. My acquaintance with Rex and Hines Baker began right away after my joining the company in 1934. They put me in an old abandoned conference room along with one other lawyer at the beginning, but Hines Baker's office was not too far away and Rex's was not too far away. And I was working immediately for Rex, and my job was to examine land titles. And that, of course, is a dreary job, and it involves a lot of reading of very badly printed material. I don't know whether you've ever seen an abstract title, but in those days they were multigraphed and very, very poorly done. And reading them was difficult, and particularly for one with bad eyes. But that was my job. As soon as I would get through reading one stack of abstracts and write an opinion on the title, another stack would be deposited on my table. I didn't have a desk, I just had a table. I didn't even have a telephone, as a matter of fact. There wasn't a telephone in the conference room where we were. That was the state of affairs. I can't help but compare it to the day at Barrett's starting at Baker Botts, where he not only has an office to himself with his name on the door, but a telephone and all of the amenities of office. Well, in 1934, I didn't have any of these. I was glad to have a job. I sat on a rather hard chair with no cushion in that conference room for a very long time, doing work that was not particularly interesting, but which was, of course, necessary and vital for an oil company. The procedure was that the Humble Company was doing a lot of what they call wildcat drilling. They were drilling prospects to see whether they could discover oil in new places, and before they did, they had to examine the title to the land to see whether the title was good, or see what exceptions existed, or whether there was somebody in possession contrary to the record title holder, and in general checking up on many ramifications of the title. And many controversies, of course, arose out of the title to lands on which the company had drilled. There were you can't imagine the types of claims that were made, because when land was cheap and only worth a few dollars an acre, people couldn't afford to bother about making claims for small interest. But when the land got real valuable and became oil-producing land, all of those claims got puffed up and everybody made